even accepted the invitation. She knew now she couldn't go unless the bruise had disappeared completely.
Well, you let me know when you're going over there, and when you get back, you hear? I got to know if you're out of town. Cause if and I don't see you for more than a day or so, I'm going out to your place myself. Bring along a posse if need be.
I will. Thank you, Jumpin'. Chapter 47 The Expert 1970 Prosecutor Eric Chastain had been questioning the sheriff about the two boys who discovered Chase Andrews's body at the base of the fire tower on October 30th, the doctor's examination, and the initial investigation. Eric continued.
Sheriff, please tell us what led you to believe that Chase Andrews had not fallen from the tower by accident. What made you think a crime had been committed?
Well, one of the first things I noticed was there weren't any footprints around Chase's body, not even his own, except those made by the boys who found him, so I figured somebody had destroyed them to cover up a crime.
Isn't it also true, Sheriff, that there were no fingerprints and no vehicle tracks at the scene?
Yeah, that's correct. The lab reports stated there were no fresh fingerprints on the tower, not even on the grate, which somebody had to open. My deputy and I searched for vehicle tracks, and there weren't any of those either. All this indicated that someone had purposely destroyed evidence.
So when the lab reports proved that red wool fibers from Miss Clark's hat were found on Chase's clothing that night, you...
Objection, Your Honor, Tom said, leading the witness, and besides, testimony has already established that the red fibers could have been transferred from Miss Clark's clothing to those of Mr. Andrews prior to the night of October 29th to 30th.
Sustained, the judge boomed.
No more questions. Your witness.
Eric had known the sheriff's testimony would be somewhat weak for the prosecution. What can you do with no murder weapon and no finger, foot, or truck prints? But there was still enough meat and gravy to convince the jury someone had murdered Chase. And considering the red fibers, that someone could have been Miss Clark. Tom Milton walked to the witness box.
Sheriff, did you or anybody else ask an expert to look for footprints or for evidence that footprints were wiped out?
That wasn't necessary. I am the expert. Footprint examination is part of my official training. I didn't need another expert.
I see. So, was there evidence that footprints had been wiped off the ground? I mean, for example, were there marks from a brush or branch to cover tracks? Or was there mud moved on top of other mud? Any evidence? Any photographs of such an act?
No. I'm here to testify as an expert that there were no footprints under the tower except ours and the boys. So somebody had to have wiped them out.
Okay, but Sheriff, it's a physical characteristic of the marsh that as the tides come in and out, the groundwater, even far beyond the tide, goes up and down, making areas dry for a while, then a few hours later, the water rises again. In many places, as the water rises, it soaks the area, wiping out any marks in the mud, such as footprints. Clean slate. Isn't that true?
Well, yeah, it can be like that. But there's no evidence that something like that occurred.
I have here the tide table for the night of October 29th and the morning of October 30th. And see, Sheriff Jackson, it shows that low tide was around midnight. So at the time Chase arrived at the tower and walked to the steps, he would have made tracks in the wet mud. Then when the tide came in and the groundwater rose, his tracks were wiped out. That's the reason you and the boys made deep tracks, and the same reason that Chase's prints were gone. Do you agree that this is possible?
Kaya nodded slightly, her first reaction to testimony since the trial began. Many times she'd seen Marshwater swallow yesterday's story. Deer prints by a creek or bobcat tracks near a dead fawn vanished. The sheriff answered.
Well, I've never seen it wipe out anything so complete as that, so I don't know. But, Sheriff, as you said, you're the expert, trained in footprint examination. And now you say you don't know if this common occurrence happened that night or not. Well, it wouldn't be that hard to prove one way or the other, would it? Just go out there at low tide, make some tracks, and see if they are wiped out when the tide comes in. Yes, it wouldn't be that hard to determine one way or the other, so why wasn't it done? Here we are in court, and you have no proof whatsoever that a person wiped away footprints to cover a crime. It's more likely that Chase Andrews did leave prints under the tower, and that they were washed away by the rising groundwater. And if some friends had been with him to climb the tower for fun, their footprints would have been washed away as well. Under these very likely circumstances, there is no suggestion whatsoever of a crime. Isn't that correct, Sheriff?
Ed's eyes darted left, right, left, right, as if the answer were on the walls. People shifted on the benches.
Sheriff? Tom repeated. In my professional opinion, it seems unlikely that a normal cycle of rising groundwater would completely wash away footprints to the extent that they disappeared in this case. However, since there was no sign of a cover-up, the absence of footprints does not, by itself, prove there was a crime. But, thank you.
Tom turned toward the jury and repeated the sheriff's words.
The absence of footprints does not prove there was a crime. Now, moving on, Sheriff. What about the grate that was left open on the floor of the fire tower? Did you examine it for Miss Clark's fingerprints? Yes, of course we did. And did you find Miss Clark's fingerprints on the grate or anywhere on the tower? No. No, but we didn't find any other fingerprints either, so...
The judge leaned over.
Only answer the questions, Ed. What about hair? Miss Clark has long black hair. If she had climbed all the way to the top and was busy on the platform, opening a grate and such, I would expect there to be strands of her hair. Did you find any?
No. The sheriff's brow glistened.
The coroner testified that after examining Chase's body, there was no evidence that Miss Clark was in close proximity to him that night. Oh, there were those fibers, but they could have been 4 years old. And now you're telling us that there is no evidence whatsoever that Miss Clark was even on the fire tower that night. Is that a correct statement?
Yes.
So, we have no evidence that proves Miss Clark was on the fire tower the night Chase Andrews fell to his death. Correct?
That's what I said.
So that's a yes.
Yeah, that's a yes.
Sheriff, isn't it true that those grates on top of the tower were left open quite frequently by kids playing up there?
Yeah, they were left open sometimes. But like I said earlier, it was usually the one you had to open to climb on top, not the other ones.
But isn't it true that the grate by the stairs, and occasionally the others, were left open so often and considered so dangerous that your office submitted a written request to the U.S. Forest Service to remedy the situation?
Tom held a document out to the sheriff.
Is this the official request to the Forest Service on July 18th of last year?
The sheriff looked at the page.
Yeah, that's it.
Who exactly wrote this request?
I did it myself.
So only 3 months before Chase Andrews fell to his death through an open grate on the fire tower, you submitted a written request to the Forest Service asking them to close the tower or secure the grates so that no one would be hurt. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Sheriff, would you please read to the court the last sentence of this document that you wrote to the Forest Service? Just the last sentence here.
He handed the document to the sheriff, pointing at the last line. The sheriff read out loud to the court,
I must repeat, these grates are very dangerous, and if action is not taken, a serious injury or even death will occur. I have no further questions.
Chapter 48 A Trip, 1969. On October 28, 1969, Kaya eased up to Jumpin's dock to tell him goodbye, as promised, then motored to the town wharf, where fishermen and shrimpers, as always, stopped their work to watch her. Ignoring them, she tied up and carried a faded cardboard suitcase, pulled from the back of Ma's old closet onto Main Street. She had no purse, but toted her knapsack packed with books, some ham and biscuits, and a small amount of cash, after burying most of her royalty money in a tin can near the lagoon. For once, she looked quite normal, dressed in a brown Sears Roebuck skirt, white blouse, and flats. Shopkeepers busied about, tending customers, sweeping the sidewalk, every one of them staring at her. She stood on the corner under the bus stop sign, and waited until the Trailways bus, its air brakes hissing, pulled up, blocking the ocean. Nobody got off or on as Kaya stepped forward and bought a ticket to Greenville from the driver. When she asked about the return dates and times, he handed her a printed schedule and then stowed her suitcase. She held tightly to her knapsack and boarded. And before she had time to think much about it, the bus, which seemed as long as the town, drove out of Barkley Cove. 2 days later, at 1:16 in the afternoon, Kaya stepped off the Trailways from Greenville. Now even more villagers were about, staring and whispering as she tossed her long hair over her shoulder and took her suitcase from the driver. She crossed the street to the wharf, stepped into her boat, and motored straight home. She wanted to stop by and tell Jumpin' that she was back, as she had promised to do, but other boats were lined up waiting for gas at his wharf, so she figured she'd come back the next day. Besides, this way, she'd get back to the Gulls faster. So, the next morning, October 31st, as she pulled up to Jumpin's wharf, she called to him, and he stepped out from the small store.
Hey, Jumpin', I'm just letting you know I'm home. Got back yesterday.
He said nothing as he walked toward her. As soon as she stepped onto his wharf, he said,
Miss Kaya, I...
She cocked her head.
What is it? What's wrong?
He stood looking at her.
Kaya, have you heard the news about Mr. Chase?
No. What news? He shook his head.
Chase Andrews is dead. Died in the middle of the night while you were over in Greenville.
What? Both Kaya and Jumpin' looked deep into the other's eyes.
They found him yesterday morning at the bottom of the old far tower with a... Well, they say his neck broke and his skull smashed right in. They reckon he fell right off from the top.
Kaya's lips remained parted. Jumpin' went on.
Whole town's buzzed up. Some folks are putting it down as an accident, but the word is, the sheriff ain't so sure. Chase's mama's all riled up, says there was foul play. It's a sure enough mess.
Kaya asked,
Why do they think foul play was...
One of them grates on the tower floor was left wide open, and he fell plump through, and they reckoned that was suspicious. Some people are saying them grates are left open all the time, with kids always messing round up there, and Mr. Chase could have fell through by accident. But some folks crying murder.
Kaya was silent, so Jumpin' continued.
One reason was, when Mr. Chase was found, he wasn't wearing that shell necklace he wore every day for years. And his wife says he was wearing it that very night when he left the house before he went to his folks for dinner. Always wore it, she said.
Her mouth went dry at the mention of the necklace.
Then those two young'uns that found Chase, well, they heard the sheriff say there weren't no footprints at the scene. Nary a one. Like somebody done rubbed out evidence. Them boys been yapping all over town about it.
Jumpin' told her when the funeral would be, but knew Kaya wouldn't go. What a spectacle that would be for the sewing bees and Bible study groups. For sure, the speculation and gossip would include Kaya.
Thank the Lord she'd been in Greenville at the time of his death, or they'd have put this on her,
Jumpin' thought. Kaya nodded at Jumpin' and turned home. She stood on the mud bank of the lagoon, whispering one of Amanda Hamilton's verses. Never underrate the heart, capable of deeds the mind cannot conceive. The heart dictates as well as feels. How else can you explain the path I have taken, that you have taken, the long way through this pass? Chapter 49 Disguises 1970 Stating his name as Mr. Larry Price, a man with curly white hair cut short and dressed in a blue suit that shone cheaply, and that he drove the Trailways bus on varying routes in this area of North Carolina, the next witness was sworn in. As Eric questioned him, Mr. Price confirmed that it was possible to bus from Greenville to Barkley Cove and back again on the same night. He also stated that he was driving the bus from Greenville bound for Barkley Cove the night Chase died, and none of the passengers looked like Miss Clark. Eric said,
Now, Mr. Price, you told the sheriff during his investigation that there was a skinny passenger on that bus who could have been a tall woman disguised as a man. Is that correct? Please describe this passenger.
Yeah, that's right. A young white man. Reckon he was about 5'10", and his pants just hung on him like sheets on a fence post. He wore a big bulky cap, blue, kept his head down, didn't look at anybody.
And now that you've seen Miss Clark, do you believe it's possible that the skinny man on the bus was Miss Clark in disguise? Could her long hair have been hidden in that bulky cap?
Yeah, I do.
Eric asked the judge to request that Kaya stand up, and she did so, with Tom Milton by her side.
You can sit back down, Miss Clark,
Eric said, and then to the witness.
Would you say that the young man on the bus was the same height and stature as Miss Clark?
I'd say about exactly the same,
Mr. Price said.
So all things considered, would you say that it's likely that the skinny man on the 11:50 p.m. bus traveling from Greenville to Barkley Cove on the night of October 29th of last year was, in fact, the defendant, Miss Clark?
Yeah, I'd say that's very possible.
Thank you, Mr. Price. No further questions. Your witness.
Tom stood in front of the witness stand, and after 5 minutes of questioning Mr. Price, he summed up,
What you've told us is this. One, there was no woman who looked like the defendant on the bus from Greenville to Barkley Cove on the night of October 29th, 1969. Two, there was a tall, thin man on the bus, but At the time, even though you saw his face very close, you didn't think of him as a woman in disguise. 3, this idea of disguise only came to you when the sheriff suggested it.
Tom continued before the witness could respond.
Mr. Price, tell us how you're sure the thin man was on the 11:50 p.m. bus of October 29th. Did you take notes, write it down? Maybe it was the night before or the night after. Are you 100% sure it was October 29th?
Well, I see what you're getting at. And when the sheriff was jogging my memory, it seemed like that man was on that bus. But now, I reckon I can't be 100% sure.
Also, Mr. Price, wasn't the bus very late that night? In fact, it was 25 minutes late, and didn't arrive in Barkley Cove until 1:40 in the morning. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Mr. Price looked at Eric.
I'm just trying to help out here. Do the right thing.
Tom reassured him.
You've been a great help, Mr. Price. Thank you very much. No further questions.
Eric called his next witness, the driver for the 2:30 a.m. bus from Barkley Cove to Greenville on the morning of October 30th, a Mr. John King. He testified that the defendant, Miss Clark, was not on the bus, but there was an older lady.
Tall like Miss Clark, who had gray hair, short with curls, like a permanent wave.
Looking at the defendant, Mr. King, is it possible that if Miss Clark had disguised herself as an older lady, she would have looked similar to the woman on the bus?
Well, it's hard to picture it. Maybe.
So it's possible.
Yes, I guess.
On cross, Tom said,
we cannot accept the word guess in a murder trial. Did you see the defendant, Miss Clark, on the 2:30 a.m. bus from Barkley Cove to Greenville in the early morning of October 30th, 1969?
No, I did not.
And was there another bus from Barkley Cove to Greenville that night?
No.
Chapter 50. The Journal. 1970. When Kaya was led into the courtroom the next day, she glanced toward Tate, Jumpin', and Mabel and held her breath at seeing a full uniform, a slight smile across a scarred face. Jody. She nodded slightly, wondering how he'd learned of her trial. Probably the Atlanta paper. She tucked her head in shame. Eric stood.
Your Honor, if it please the court, the people call Mrs. Sam Andrews.
The room breathed out as Patty Love, the grieving mother, made her way to the witness stand. Watching the woman she'd once hoped would be her mother-in-law, Kaya now realized the absurdity of that notion. Even in this sullen setting, Patty Love, dressed in the finest black silks, seemed preoccupied with her own appearance and importance. She sat straight with her glossy purse perched on her lap, dark hair swept into the perfect bun under a hat, tipped just so, with dramatic black netting obscuring her eyes. Never would she have taken a barefoot marsh dweller as a daughter-in-law.
Mrs. Andrews, I know this is difficult for you, so I'll be as brief as possible. Is it true that your son, Chase Andrews, wore a rawhide necklace hung with a shell?
Yes, that's true.
And when, how often did he wear that necklace?
All the time. He never took it off. For 4 years, I never saw him without that necklace.
Eric handed a leather journal to Mrs. Andrews.
Can you identify this book for the court?
Kaya stared at the floor, working her lips, enraged at this invasion of her privacy as the prosecutor held her journal for all the court to see. She'd made it for Chase very soon after they met. Most of her life, She'd been denied the joy of giving gifts, a deprivation few understand. After working for days and nights on the journal, she'd wrapped it in brown paper and decorated it with striking green ferns and white feathers from snow geese. She'd held it out as Chase stepped from his boat onto the lagoon shore.
"What's this?"
"Just something from me,"
she had said, and smiled. A painted story of their times together. The first, an ink sketch of them sitting against the driftwood, Chase playing the harmonica. The Latin names of the sea oats and scattered shells were printed in Kaya's hand. A swirl of watercolors revealed his boat drifting in moonlight. The next was an abstract image of curious porpoises circling the boat, with the words, "Michael row the boat ashore," drifting in the clouds. Another of her swirling among silver gulls on a silver beach. Chase had turned the pages in wonder, ran his fingers lightly over some of the drawings, laughed at some, but mostly was silent, nodding.
"I've never had anything like this."
Leaning over to embrace her, he had said,
"Thank you, Kaya."
They sat on the sand a while, wrapped in blankets, talking, holding hands. Kaya remembered how her heart had pounded at the joy of giving, never imagining anyone else would see the journal, certainly not as evidence at her murder trial. She didn't look at Patty Love when she answered Eric's question.
"It's a collection of paintings that Miss Clark made for Chase. She gave it to him as a present."
Patty Love remembered finding the journal under a stack of albums while cleaning his room, apparently hidden from her. She'd sat on Chase's bed and opened the thick cover. There, in detailed ink, her son lying against driftwood with that girl. The marsh girl. Her Chase with trash. She could barely breathe.
"What if people find out?"
First cold, then sweaty, her body reeled.
"Mrs. Andrews, would you please explain what you see in this picture painted by the defendant, Miss Clark?"
"That's a painting of Chase and Miss Clark on the top of the fire tower."
A murmur moved through the room.
"What else is going on?"
"There, between their hands, she is giving him the shell necklace." "And he never took it off again,"
Patty Love thought.
"I believed that he told me everything. I thought I'd bonded with my son more than other mothers. That's what I told myself. But I knew nothing."
"So, because he told you, and because of this journal, you knew your son was seeing Miss Clark, and you knew she gave him the necklace?"
"Yes."
"When Chase came to your house for dinner on the night of October 29th, was he wearing the necklace?"
"Yes, he didn't leave our house until after 11, and he was wearing the necklace."
"Then when you went into the clinic the next day to identify Chase, did he have the necklace on?"
"No, he did not."
"Do you know of any reason why any of his friends or anyone else, besides Miss Clark, would want to take the necklace off, Chase?"
"No."
"Objection, Your Honor," Tom called quickly from his seat. "Hearsay. Calls for speculation. She can't speak to the reasoning of other people." "Sustained. Jurors, you must disregard the last question and answer."
Then, lowering his head gander-like at the prosecutor, the judge said,
"Watch your step, Eric. For crying out loud, you know better than that."
Eric, unfazed, continued.
"All right. We know from her own drawings that the defendant, Miss Clark, climbed the fire tower with Chase at least once. We know she gave the shell necklace to him. After that, he wore it continuously until the night he died, at which time it disappeared. Is all that correct?"
"Yes."
"Thank you. No further questions.
your witness. No questions, Tom said.
Chapter 51 Waning Moon, 1970. The language of the court was, of course, not as poetic as the language of the marsh. Yet Kaya saw similarities in their natures. The judge, obviously the alpha male, was secure in his position, so his posture was imposing, but relaxed and unthreatened as the territorial boar. Tom Milton, too, exuded confidence and rank with easy movements and stance. A powerful buck, acknowledged as such. The prosecutor, on the other hand, relied on wide, bright ties and broad-shouldered suit jackets to enhance his status. He threw his weight by flinging his arms or raising his voice. A lesser male needs to shout to be noticed. The bailiff represented the lowest-ranking male and depended on his belt hung with glistening pistol, clanging wad of keys, and clunky radio to bolster his position.
Dominance hierarchies enhance stability in natural populations, and some less natural, Kaya thought.
The prosecutor, wearing a scarlet tie, stepped boldly to the front and called his next witness, Hal Miller, a rake-thin 28-year-old with moppy brown hair.
Mr. Miller, please tell us where you were and what you saw the night of October 29th to 30th, 1969, at about 1:45 a.m.
Me and Alan Hunt were crewing for Tim O'Neill on his shrimp boat, and we were headed back to Barkley Cove Harbor late, and we seen her, Ms. Clark, in her boat, about a mile out, east of the bay, headed north-northwest.
And where would that course take her?
Right smack to that cove near the fire tower.
Judge Sims banged his gavel at the outburst, which rumbled for a full minute.
Could she not have been going somewhere else?
Well, I reckon, but there's nothing up that way but miles of swamped-out woods. No other destination I know of except the fire tower.
Ladies' funeral fans pumped against the warming, unsettled room. Sunday Justice, sleeping on the windowsill, flowed to the floor and walked to Kaya. For the first time in the courtroom, he rubbed against her leg, then jumped onto her lap and settled. Eric stopped talking and looked at the judge, perhaps considering an objection for such an open display of partiality, but there seemed no legal precedent.
How can you be sure it was Miss Clark?
Oh, we all know her boat. She's been boating around on her own for years.
Were there lights on her boat?
No, no lights. Might have run her over if we hadn't seen her.
But isn't it illegal to operate a boat after dark without lights?
Yeah, she was supposed to have lights, but she didn't.
So on the night that Chase Andrews died at the fire tower, Miss Clark was boating in exactly that direction just minutes before the time of his death. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we seen.
Eric sat down. Tom walked toward the witness.
Good morning, Mr. Miller.
Good morning.
Mr. Miller, how long have you been serving as a crew member on Tim O'Neill's shrimp boat?
Going on 3 years now.
And tell me, please, what time did the moon rise the night of October 29th to the 30th?
It was waning, and didn't rise until after we docked in Barkley, sometime after 2 a.m., I reckon.
I see. So when you saw the small boat motoring near Barkley Cove that night, there was no moon. It must have been very dark.
Yeah, it was dark. There was some starlight, but yeah, pretty dark.
Would you please tell the court what Miss Clark was wearing as she motored past you in her boat that night?
Well, we weren't near close enough to see what she was wearing.
Oh, you weren't near enough to see her clothes.
Tom looked at the jury as he said this.
Well, how far away were you?
I reckon we was a good 60 yards away, at least.
60 yards?
Tom looked at the jury again.
That's quite a distance to identify a small boat in the dark. Tell me, Mr. Miller, what characteristics, what features of this person in this boat made you so sure it was Miss Clark?
Well, like I said, about everybody in this town knows her boat, how it looks from close and far. We know the shape of the boat and the figure she cut sitting in the stern, tall, thin like that. A very particular shape. A particular shape. So, anybody with this same shape, any person who was tall and thin in this type of boat would have looked like Miss Clark, correct?
I guess somebody else could have looked like her. But we get to know boats and their owners real good, you know, being out there all the time. But, Mr. Miller, may I remind you, this is a murder trial. It cannot get more serious than this. And in these cases, we have to be certain. We can't go by shapes or forms that are seen from 60 yards away in the dark. So please, can you tell the court you are certain the person you saw on the night of October 29th to October 30th, 1969, was Miss Clark?
Well, no, I can't be completely sure. Never said I could be completely sure it was her, but I'm pretty.
That will be all, Mr. Miller. Thank you.
Judge Sims asked, "Redirect, Eric." From his seat, Eric asked,
"Hal, you testified that you've been seeing and recognizing Miss Clark in her boat for at least 3 years. Tell me, have you ever thought you saw Miss Clark in her boat from a distance, and then, once you got closer, you discovered that it wasn't Miss Clark after all? Has that ever happened?"
"No, not once."
"Not once in 3 years?"
"Not once in 3 years."
Your Honor, the state rests.
Chapter 52. Three Mountains Motel. 1970. Judge Sims entered the courtroom and nodded at the defense table.
"Mr. Milton, are you ready to call your first witness for the defense?"
"I am, Your Honor."
"Proceed."
After the witness was sworn and seated, Tom said,
"Please state your name and what you do in Barkley Cove."
Kaya raised her head enough to see the short, elderly woman with the purplish-white hair and tight perm, who years ago asked her why she always came alone to the grocery. Perhaps she was shorter and her curls tighter, but she looked remarkably the same. Mrs. Singletary had seemed nosy and bossy, but she had given Kaya the net Christmas stocking with the blue whistle inside the winter after Ma left. It was all the Christmas Kaya had.
"I'm Sarah Singletary, and I clerk at the Piggly Wiggly Market in Barkley Cove."
"Sarah, is it correct that from your cash register within the Piggly Wiggly, you can see the Trailways bus stop?"
"Yes, I can see it clearly."
"On October 28th of last year, did you see the defendant, Miss Catherine Clark, waiting at the bus stop at 2:30 p.m.?
"Yes, I saw Miss Clark standing there."
At this, Sarah glanced at Kaya and remembered the little girl coming barefoot into the market for so many years. No one would ever know, but before Kaya could count, Sarah had given the child extra change, money she had to take from her own purse to balance the register. Of course, Kaya was dealing with small sums to start with, so Sarah contributed only nickels and dimes, but it must have helped.
"How long did she wait? And did you actually see her step onto the 2:30 p.m. bus?"
"She waited about 10 minutes, I think." We all saw her buy her ticket from the driver, give him her suitcase, and step onto the bus. It drove away, and she was most definitely inside.
And I believe you also saw her return 2 days later on October 30th on the 1:16 p.m. bus. Is that correct?
Yes. 2 days later, a little after 1:15 in the afternoon, I looked up as the bus stopped and there was Miss Clark stepping off it. I pointed her out to the other checkout ladies.
Then what did she do?
She walked to the wharf, got in her boat, and headed south.
Thank you, Sarah. That will be all.
Judge Sims asked,
Any questions, Eric?
No, Your Honor, I have no questions. In fact, I see from the witness list that the defense intends to call several townspeople to testify that Miss Clark got on and off the Trailways bus on the dates and times Mrs. Singletary has stated. The prosecution does not refute this testimony. Indeed, it is consistent with our case that Miss Clark traveled on those buses at those times, and if it pleased the court, it is not necessary to hear from other witnesses on this matter.
All right. Miss Singletary, you can step down. What about you, Mr. Milton? If the prosecution accepts the fact that Miss Clark got on the 2:30 bus on October 28, 1969, and returned at about 1:16 on October 30th, 1969. Do you need to call other witnesses to this effect?
No, Your Honor.
His face appeared calm, but Tom swore inside. Kaya's alibi of being out of town at the time of Chase's death was one of the strongest points for the defense. But Eric had successfully diluted the alibi simply by accepting it, even stating that he didn't need to hear testimony that Kaya traveled to and from Greenville during the day. It didn't matter to the prosecution's case, because they claimed Kaya had returned to Barkley at night and committed the murder. Tom had foreseen the risk, but thought it crucial that the jury hear testimony, to visualize Kaya leaving town in daylight and not returning until after the incident. Now they'd think her alibi wasn't important enough, even to be confirmed.
Noted. Please proceed with your next witness.
Bald and fubsy, his coat buttoned tight against a round belly, Mr. Lang Furlow testified that he owned and operated the Three Mountains Motel in Greenville, and that Miss Clark had stayed at the motel from October 28th until October 30th, 1969. Kaya detested listening to this oily-haired man, who she never thought she'd see again, and here he was talking about her as though she weren't present. He explained how he had shown her to her motel room, but failed to mention he had lingered too long. Kept thinking of reasons to stay in her room until she opened the door, hinting for him to leave. When Tom asked how he could be sure of Miss Clark's comings and goings from the motel, he chuckled and said she was the kind of woman men notice. He added how strange she was, not knowing how to use the telephone, walking from the bus station with a cardboard suitcase, and bringing her own bagged dinner.
Mr. Furlow, on the next night, that being October 29th, 1969, the night Chase Andrews died, you worked at the reception desk all night. Is that correct?
Yes.
After Miss Clark returned to her room at 10 p.m. after dinner with her editor, did you see her leave again? At any time during the night of October 29th or the early morning hours of October 30th, did you see her leave or return to her room?
No. I was there all night, and I never saw her leave her room. Like I said, her room was directly across from the reception counter, so I would have seen her leave.
Thank you, Mr. Furlow. That's all. Your witness.
After several minutes of cross-examination, Eric continued.
Okay, Mr. Furlow, So far we have you leaving the reception area altogether to walk to your apartment twice, use the restroom, and return. The pizza boy bringing pizza, you paying him, etc. Four guests checking in, two checking out. And in between all that, you completed your receipts account. Now, I'd submit, Mr. Furlough, that during all that commotion, there were plenty of times that Miss Clark could have quietly walked out of her room, quickly crossed the street, and you would never have seen her. Isn't that entirely possible?
Well, I guess it's possible, but I never saw a thing. I didn't see her leave her room that night, is what I'm saying.
I understand that, Mr. Furlough. And what I'm saying is that it's very possible that Miss Clark left her room, walked to the bus station, bust to Barkley Cove, murdered Chase Andrews, and returned to her room, and you never saw her because you were very busy doing your job. No more questions.
After the lunch recess, just as everyone was settled and the judge had taken his seat, Scupper stepped inside the courtroom. Tate turned to see his father, still in his overalls and yellow marine boots, walking down the aisle. Scupper had not attended the trial because of his work, he'd said, but mostly because his son's long attachment to Miss Clark confounded him. It seemed Tate had never had feelings for any other girl, and even as a grown professional man, he still loved this strange, mysterious woman. A woman now accused of murder. Then, that noon, standing on his boat, nets pulled around his boots, Scupper breathed out heavily. His face blazed with shame as he realized that he, like some of the ignorant villagers, had been prejudiced against Kaya because she had grown up in the marsh. He remembered Tate proudly showing him Kaya's first book on shells, and how Scupper himself was taken aback by her scientific and artistic prowess. He had bought himself a copy of each of her books, but hadn't mentioned that to Tate.
What bullshit.
He was so proud of his son, how he had always known what he wanted and how to achieve it. Well, Kaya had done the same thing against much bigger odds. How could he not be there for Tate? Nothing mattered except supporting his son. He'd dropped the net at his feet, left the boat wallowing against the pier, and walked directly to the courthouse. When he reached the first row, Jody, Jumpin', and Mabel stood to allow him to squeeze by and sit next to Tate. Father and son nodded at each other, and tears swelled in Tate's eyes. Tom Milton waited for Scupper to sit, the silence in the room complete, then said,
"Your Honor, the defense calls Robert Foster."
Dressed in a tweed jacket, tie, and khaki pants, Mr. Foster was trim, of medium height, and had a neat beard and kind eyes. Tom asked his name and occupation.
"My name is Robert Foster, and I'm a senior editor for Harrison Morris Publishing Company in Boston, Massachusetts."
Kaya, hand to her forehead, stared at the floor. Her editor was the only person she knew who didn't think of her as the Marsh Girl, who had respected her, even seemed awed at her knowledge and talent. Now he was in court seeing her at the defendant's table, charged with murder.
"Are you the editor for Miss Catherine Clark's books?"
"Yes, I am. She is a very talented naturalist, artist, and writer. One of our favorite authors."
"Can you confirm that you traveled to Greenville, North Carolina, on October 28, 1969, and that you had meetings with Miss Clark on both the 29th and the 30th?
"That is correct. I was attending a small conference there, and knew I would have some extra time while in town, but wouldn't have enough time to travel to her place, so I invited Miss Clark to Greenville so we could meet."
"Can you tell us the exact time that you drove her back to her motel on the night of October 29th last year?
After our meetings, we dined at the hotel, and then I drove Kaya back to her motel at 9:55 p.m.
Kaya recalled standing on the threshold of the dining room, filled with candlelit tables under soft chandeliers, tall wine glasses on white tablecloths. Stylishly dressed diners conversed in quiet voices, while she wore the plain skirt and blouse. She and Robert dined on almond-crusted North Carolina trout, wild rice, creamed spinach, and yeast rolls. Kaya felt comfortable as he kept the conversation going with easy grace, sticking to subjects about nature familiar to her. Remembering it now, she was astonished how she had carried it off. But in fact, the restaurant, with all its glitter, wasn't nearly as grand as her favorite picnic. When she was 15, Tate had boated to her shack one dawn, and after he'd wrapped a blanket around her shoulders, they cruised inland through a maze of waterways to a forest she'd never seen. They hiked a mile to the edge of a waterlogged meadow where fresh grass sprouted through mud, and there he laid the blanket under ferns as large as umbrellas.
"Now we wait,"
he'd said, as he poured hot tea from a thermos and offered her coon balls, a baked mixture of biscuit dough, hot sausage, and sharp cheddar cheese he had cooked for the occasion. Even now, in this cold courtroom setting, she remembered the warmth of his shoulders touching hers under the blanket as they nibbled and sipped the breakfast picnic. They didn't have to wait long. Moments later, a ruckus as loud as cannons sounded from the north.
"Here they come," Tate had said.
A thin black cloud appeared on the horizon, and as it moved toward them, it soared skyward. The shrieking rose in intensity and volume as the cloud rapidly filled the sky until not one spot of blue remained. Hundreds of thousands of snow geese, flapping, honking, and gliding, covered the world. Swirling masses wheeled and banked for landing. Perhaps a half million white wings flared in unison as pink-orange feet dangled down, and a blizzard of birds came in to land. A true whiteout as everything on Earth, near and far, disappeared. One at a time, then 10 at a time, then hundreds of geese landed only yards from where Kaya and Tate had sat under the ferns. The sky emptied as the wet meadow filled until it was covered in downy snow. No fancy dining room could compare to that, and the coon balls offered more spice and flair than almond-crusted trout.
"You saw Miss Clark go into her room?"
"Of course. I opened her door and saw her safely inside before I drove away."
"Did you see Miss Clark the next day?"
"We had arranged to meet for breakfast, so I picked her up at 7:30 a.m. We ate at the Stackham High Pancake Place. I took her back to her motel at 9 o'clock. And that was the last I saw of her until today."
He glanced at Kaya, but she looked down at the table.
"Thank you, Mr. Foster. I have no further questions."
Eric stood and asked,
"Mr. Foster, I was wondering why you stayed at the Piedmont Hotel, which is the best hotel in the area, while your publishing company only paid for Miss Clark, such a talented author, one of the favorites, as you put it, to stay in a very basic motel, the Three Mountains?"
"Well, of course, we offered, even recommended, that Miss Clark stay at the Piedmont, but she insisted on staying at the motel."
"Is that so? Did she know the motel's name? Did she specifically request to stay at the Three Mountains?"
"Yes, she wrote a note saying she preferred to stay at the Three Mountains."
"Did she say why?"
"No, I don't know why."
"Well, I have an idea. Here's a tourist map of Greenville."
Eric waved the map around as he approached the witness stand.
"You can see here, Mr. Foster, that the Piedmont Hotel, the four-star hotel that you offered to Miss Clark,
is located in the downtown area. The Three Mountains Motel, on the other hand, is on Highway 258, near the Trailways bus station. In fact, if you study the map as I have, you will see that the Three Mountains is the closest motel to the bus station.
"Objection, Your Honor," Tom called out. "Mr. Foster is not an authority on the layout of Greenville."
"No, but the map is. I see where you're going, Eric, and I'll allow it. Proceed."
"Mr. Foster, if someone were planning a quick trip to the bus station in the middle of the night, it is logical that they would choose the Three Mountains over the Piedmont, especially if they plan to walk. All I need from you is the confirmation that Miss Clark asked specifically to stay at the Three Mountains and not the Piedmont."
"As I said, she requested the Three Mountains."
"I have nothing more."
"Redirect?" Judge Sims asked.
"Yes, Your Honor." "Mr. Foster, how many years have you worked with Miss Clark?"
3 years.
"And even though you didn't meet her until the visit in Greenville last October, would you say that you've gotten to know Miss Clark quite well through correspondence over those years? If so, how would you describe her?"
"Yes, I have. She is a shy, gentle person, I believe. She prefers to be alone in the wilderness. It took some time for me to convince her to come to Greenville. Certainly, she would avoid a crowd of people."
"A crowd of people like one you would encounter at a large hotel such as the Piedmont?"
"Yes."
"In fact, wouldn't you say, Mr. Foster, that it is not surprising that Miss Clark, who likes to keep to herself, would choose a small, rather remote motel over a large, bustling hotel right in town? That this choice would fit her character?"
"Yes, I would say that."
"Also, doesn't it make sense if Miss Clark, who is not familiar with public transport and knew she had to walk from the bus station to her hotel and back again, carrying a suitcase, that she would select a hotel or motel closest to the station?"
"Yes."
"Thank you. That will be all."
When Robert Foster left the witness stand, he sat with Tate, Scupper, Jody, Jumpin, and Mabel, behind Kaya. That afternoon, Tom called the sheriff back as his next witness. Kaya knew from Tom's list of witnesses that there weren't many more to be called, and the thought sickened her. The closing arguments came next, then the verdict. As long as a stream of witnesses supported her, she could hope for acquittal, or at least a delay of conviction. If the court proceedings trailed on forever, a judgment would never be handed down. She tried to lead her mind into fields of snow geese distractions, as she had since the trial began. But instead, she saw only images of jail, bars, clammy cement walls, mental inserts now and then of an electric chair, lots of straps. Suddenly, she felt she couldn't breathe, couldn't sit here any longer, her head too heavy to hold up. She sagged slightly, and Tom turned from the sheriff to Kaya as her head dropped onto her hands. He rushed to her.
"Your Honor, I request a short recess. Miss Clark needs a break."
"Granted. Court dismissed for a 15-minute recess."
Tom helped her stand and whisked her out the side door and into the small conference room, where she sank into a chair. Sitting next to her, he said,
"What is it, Kaya? What's wrong?"
She buried her head in her hands.
"How can you ask that? Isn't it obvious? How does anyone live through this? I feel too sick, too tired to sit there. Do I have to? Can't the trial continue without me?"
All she was capable of, all she wanted, was to return to her cell and curl up with Sunday justice.
"No, I'm afraid not. In a capital case such as this, the law requires your presence.
What if I can't?
What if I refuse? All they can do is throw me in jail. Kai?